Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. On today's programme, with 9 weeks to go, is Angela Merkel on course for a fourth term as German Chancellor? Calls for the EU to finally get tough on Turkey following the detention of human rights activists.
Overall, the European Union in particular, it must be said, has not been public in a clear enough way. They have not called for their release. They have not been categorical at all. They've not been strong enough. It's really a test moment.
Are inferior products being dumped on Eastern Europeans and putting a price on Jane Austen? Those stories and more coming up on the programme. There are just 9 weeks to go till the elections here in Germany. Opinion polls indicate that Christian Democrat Angela Merkel will secure a fourth consecutive term as Chancellor. However, she's just ruled out placing an upper limit on the number of refugees coming to Germany. And her open-door policy on refugees back in September 2015 was extremely contentious. So why is Merkel sticking to her guns on this issue? And is her stance likely to alienate voters? I put that to our Berlin correspondent, Daniel Peltz.
Well, Chancellor Merkel is rejecting the plan of capping the number of migrants coming to Germany precisely because the elections are coming up. She does not want to lose conservative voters who oppose migration to Germany. And she also does not want to lose support among young, educated urban voters who are generally more open to migrants. So I think she's trying to strike a balance and to appease both voting groups by, on one hand, rejecting the plan to place a limit on the number of refugees coming to Germany. But at the same time, her government has already introduced measures to reduce the number of migrants who are here. And also some of the cabinet ministers have changed the tone about migration. For instance, this week her interior minister lashed out at NGOs who are rescuing shipwrecked migrants on the Mediterranean Sea, saying they were actually aiding human traffickers through their work.
Even so, this issue threatens to open up a rift with the CDU's Bavarian sister party, the Christian Social Union, or CSU, and its leader Horst Seehofer has long called on the government to close the country's borders. And of course, Merkel needs his party's support in these upcoming elections as a coalition partner, doesn't she?
Well, actually, both parties need each other. The CSU is a regional party that is only active in Bavaria, and it can only influence national politics through its joint parliamentary group with the CDU in the lower house of the German federal parliament, the Bundestag. And the CDU, on the other hand, needs the CSU because it has a huge following among the voters there. So although the CSU has again come up with this idea to introduce an upper limit to the number of refugees and migrants coming to Germany, I think it is largely a symbolic move. And in the end, both parties will find some sort of a compromise. One possible compromise could be that they scrap the plan, but instead toughen the Immigration Act some more and then just continue to work together.
Merkel's main challenger in these elections is Martin Schulz from the Social Democrats. Now, when he entered the election race earlier this year, there was a lot of talk about the so-called Schulz effect because there was a sudden jump in support for his party. But since then, that support has fizzled out. Schulz has just unveiled his plans for a modern Germany. Do you think his policy are going to inspire voters?
It doesn't really look like it. If you look at a recent opinion poll, 52% of the voters would vote for Angela Merkel and only 22% would vote for Martin Schulz if they had a chance to elect the chancellor directly. In Germany, in real terms, the chancellor is elected by the members of the lower house of parliament. I think the SPD's campaign, also this so-called future plan that Martin Schulz has presented, have really failed to hit a nerve because the party has not managed to present itself as a real alternative to Chancellor Merkel's CDU party. The thing is that both parties have ruled together in a so-called grand coalition for the past years, and so it's very hard for the SPD to distance itself from the CDU. And also most of the proposals that Martin Schulz has made could also come from the CDU in one way or another. And the second thing is, at the moment, Germany is doing rather well. The economy is growing, unemployment is declining. So I think there is a notion among many Germans to say, why do we need to replace the chancellor in the first place?
And you think that's why she still strikes such a chord with voters, even though her standing was very much tarnished last year?
Well, Angela Merkel has a unique talent that has seen her surviving a number of political storms. Whenever there are strong sentiments among the German population about an issue, she takes them up and makes them her position, even if she had a different view before. And that's also what she did as far as migration is concerned. When the refugee crisis began 2 years ago, she was praised for keeping Germany's borders open and for accepting more than 800,000 refugees into the country. But when she started to lose popularity, she changed that position a little bit. Her government has toughened the Immigration Act. It has made it much harder to get asylum status in Germany. And the Chancellor has also publicly called for more deportations of rejected asylum seekers. A couple of months ago, Germany was actually deporting rejected asylum seekers back to Afghanistan, despite the grave security situation there. So I think that way she has managed to boost her popularity again.
And I was speaking there to our Berlin correspondent Daniel Peltz. In Turkey, a court's decision to detain six human rights activists pending trial on terrorism charges is drawing increasing national and international condemnation. The detentions are part of the ongoing crackdown following last year's failed coup. One of the jailed, Peter Steutner, is a German national, which has further escalated tensions between Berlin and Ankara. Dorian Jones has more from Istanbul.
The six human rights activists remanded in custody by an Istanbul court include Amnesty International's Turkey director İdil Eser and Özlem Dalkaran, a representative of the Helsinki Citizens' Assembly. A German and Swedish national have also been jailed. The activists were among a group of 10 arrested while attending a human rights workshop on data protection. Andrew Gardner, who is Turkey researcher for Amnesty International, says the detentions mark a new escalation in the government's attack on civic society.
It's nothing less than a travesty of justice. It's clear that defending human rights in Turkey today has been criminalised. It's an existential threat for us, pure and simple, both for Amnesty International and for the wider human rights movement in Turkey.
Those detained have been held under suspicion of supporting a terrorist organisation, which carries a 10-year sentence. The charges frequently used by prosecutors in the ongoing crackdown following last year's failed coup attempt. Over 50,000 people have been jailed since the introduction of emergency rule following the botched military takeover. Amnesty's Deputy Europe Director, Gary Van Guluk, says the latest detentions are a critical test for the European Union to take a stand against Ankara.
Overall, the European Union in particular, it must be said, has not been public in a clear enough way. They have not called for their release. They have not been categorical at all. They've not been strong enough. It's really a test moment.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel has slammed the arrests, describing them as totally unjustified. And Germany has raised the possibility of suspending EU payments to Turkey. But despite the tough words, there is scepticism whether Berlin and the rest of the EU is ready to take a stand. Emma Sinclair Webb, chief researcher on Turkey for the US-based Human Rights Watch, says her dealings with European diplomats suggest Brussels has other priorities.
The European Union is still focused on cooperation over counter-terrorism and migration, and they leave little space for any engagement on Turkey's disastrous political context and disastrous human rights crisis.
President Recep Tayyip Erdogan appears all too aware of his strong position and is doubling down on his rhetoric to robustly defend the arrests. He claims that detained activists have been part of an ongoing conspiracy that sought to oust him from power last year. Nearly 250 people were killed resisting the military takeover, and commemorations have just taken place to mark the first anniversary of the defeat of the coup. Erdogan used a keynote speech at Istanbul's Martyrs Bridge, where 36 people were gunned down by soldiers taking part in the coup, to accuse foreign powers of working hand in hand with conspirators in Turkey.
There are so many enemies lying in ambush, unwilling to grant us the right of existence. If I name them one by one, we will be confronted with a very serious international crisis.
Dozens of Turkish diplomats and military personnel who are accused by Ankara of being involved in the failed coup are seeking political asylum in Germany. So Ankara makes little secret of the fact that it sees Germany as one of the countries conspiring against it. Germany has also become a center for opposition to Erdogan.
İyi akşamlar sevgili seyirciler. Gündem özel yayınımızla karşınızdayız.
This is Halk TV, an opposition TV station, which now broadcasts to Turkey from Germany. 10 German nationals are now being held in the ongoing crackdown, including prominent journalist Deniz Yücel. Emma Sinclair Webb of Human Rights Watch says they've become diplomatic pawns.
When you focus on individuals, especially foreigners who are detained, there's a sense in which imprisoning people becomes almost a form of blackmail, a form of bargaining. And that's what we're also seeing. So in that sense, when Germany raises the case of Deniz Yücel, the journalist who's in prison, in the minds of Turkey's political leaders, Deniz Yücel becomes even more of a bargaining tool. And there becomes a resistance to releasing him without basically using him to achieve things that Turkey wants from Europe or from Germany.
Ankara dismisses such accusations, claiming the judiciary is independent. But the European Union, and especially Berlin, could be paying the price for all but freezing Ankara's bid to join the EU for more than a decade. Merkel has been one of the most outspoken critics of this bid. So Turkish disillusionment over its prospects for EU membership means any threat to end talks carries little threat. Semih Adiz is a political columnist with Al Monitor website. He warns that despite growing international criticism, in particular from Berlin, Erdogan believes he has the upper hand.
This whole harks back to the 90s and the year 2000s when, you know, Turkey's EU membership was accepted. But as soon as it was accepted and negotiations started, Germany and France started saying, well, this may not lead to full membership and Turkey's not a European country and all this. So there's really very little stick that Europe has. And we have President Erdogan. He's very bullish. He's very uncompromising and all that. And I think European leaders really don't know how to cope with him. And Merkel does look embarrassed. But that's the way it's being played.
President Erdogan continues to insist that the crackdown is about defending democracy. And he says that there'll be no let-up in the crackdown, promising to rip off the heads of traitors and more pain to come for Turkey's enemies at home and abroad. Doreen Jones, DW, Istanbul.
And I'm Helen Sinian-Bon. You're listening to Inside Europe. The Czech agriculture minister has called for the pressure to be kept up on the European Commission to resolve the problem of so-called dual-quality food. People in the former Eastern Bloc have long complained that food sold in their countries is of inferior quality to identical products sold further west. Governments in the region, armed with scientific tests to prove it, are now upping the pressure on the EU to do something about it. Rob Cameron has more from Prague.
A cashier running groceries through the register as a Czech family loads them into two large shopping trolleys. They're full of the typical family fare: coffee, tea, chocolate, yogurt, ham, sausage, cheese. But this is not your typical Czech family doing their weekly shop, because the supermarket is in Germany. Petr Zedinek, his wife Sharka, and their teenage daughter Clara have driven about 20 minutes from their home in the Czech village of Modlany across the border to the German town of Altenburg to visit one of two small supermarkets. What they're buying is regular produce. The same stuff in identical packaging and under the same brands is on sale in supermarkets, many of them German-owned supermarkets, at home in the Czech Republic. But as Petr explains, what's inside is incomparably different.
Další příklad, tak tady je třeba konzerva tuňáka. stojí 1 euro.
Look, here's another example for you. A can of tuna fish. It costs 1 euro. At home in the Czech Republic, the same can costs at least 1.5 times as much. But this stuff here is good quality fish. It's not all mashed up. It's real whole bits of tuna. Or these sausages. Look, 87% meat content. Try and find sausages with 87% meat content in the Czech Republic. It's a problem.
Out in the car park, his wife Šárka gives me her opinion.
All the girls at work talk about where to buy the best stuff. Where in Germany, I mean. The girls in the same office as me all go shopping in Germany too. It's crazy, but unfortunately, that's the way it is. If we want good quality produce, we have to drive across the border for it. And everyone's doing it. In Modvlani alone, we know lots of families who do their shopping there.
The issue, which affects a host of countries across Central and Eastern Europe, has now become a political football. The governments of the Visegrad Group, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary and Poland, have made it a high priority goal to get the European Commission to bring about legal changes to outlaw the practice. At present, EU law merely requires food producers to list all the ingredients. There is no legislation which says if you're a producer selling a tin of tuna fish in a pink can under a certain brand, then it has to contain exactly the same quantity and quality of fish when sold in the Czech Republic as it does when it's sold in Germany. The producers themselves merely say that they alter products to cater for local tastes, but Central Europeans are simply and often literally not buying it. The Czech Agriculture Minister Marian Jurečka recently held a special press briefing on the issue, holding up two virtually identical packets of frozen fish fingers, one sold in the Czech Republic and one sold in Germany, by way of illustration.
If I hold them up, you can see they look exactly the same. The packaging is the same. They were, in fact, packaged in the same factory. But there's a fundamental difference between them. For one thing, the pack for the German market is substantially heavier, despite there being the same number of fish fingers in each pack. And for the German consumer, there's more fish in each finger. And also the price. German customers pay 0.41 euros per 100 grams, while Czech customers pay 0.77 euros. So what we're saying loud and clear is, in this case, the German consumer is getting a completely different quality than the Czech consumer for a completely different price.
The fact of dual quality products has been scientifically proven. Czechs and others across the region now know that there is less fish in their fish fingers, less tea extract in their iced tea, less hazelnut in their hazelnut spread. Bringing about legal changes is another matter. For now, many people, many thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, take matters into their own hands by driving across the border into Austria or Germany. But they're hoping that one day they won't have to, and the same quality products will simply come to them. Rob Cameron, DW, Prague.
The Bank of England has just unveiled a new £10 note. Adorning the new currency is the image of one of the world's best known and most highly esteemed writers of romantic fiction, Jane Austen. She died exactly 200 years ago and is buried in the southern English city of Winchester. Putting Austen's portrait on the new £10 note is a very fitting bicentenary tribute. The novelist not only wrote about love and marriage, but also took an extremely keen interest in money. From Winchester Cathedral, Stephen Beard reports.
These doors date from 1500.
Tour guide Yvonne Fernley addresses a group of devotees who've come to pay homage to a secular saint.
May I welcome you to Winchester Cathedral. And we're both privileged, I think, and humbled because we have her here.
For two centuries, Jane Austen has lain in a grave under the cathedral floor, not quite undisturbed.
I have to tell you, she was moved. 1950s, they put the central heating in. The main pipe comes down the north aisle and they had to just move her over a little bit. But she's nice and warm in the winter.
The author might have relished the irony of that posthumous slight, but how would she feel about appearing on a £10 bill? Catherine Sutherland, Professor of Literature at Oxford University.
I think she would be very amused by it. A woman who, throughout her writing life, was concerned with the profit she was making. But I think she would be both proud and amused to find herself on a banknote.
Sutherland has curated an Austin exhibition here at Oxford's Bodleian Library. It sheds light on the many different facets of the writer's character, not least as the unmarried daughter of an impoverished clergyman on her personal fixation with money.
You might want to look at Jane Austen, as it were, the material girl, as she is living her life in London. This is a
one of the exhibits here, exactly a silk overcoat that cost Austen almost 20% of her annual earnings.
So, you know, it's a sizable amount of her money. And she was splashing out on a garment. And I think it's her saying, you know, I've arrived. I'm somebody.
Anyone that's read her novels or seen the movies will recognise, along with the elegant Regency interiors, that blatant emphasis on cash. Take Mrs. Bennet's exulting over the income of her daughter's new fiancé.
Exceed their income? What are you talking about? Don't you know he has 5,000 a year? Oh, my dear Jane, I am so...
Even Elizabeth Bennet, the heroine of Pride and Prejudice, betrays a sneaking regard for her suitor's wealth. Initially, she insists she will only marry for love and roundly rebuffs the rich Mr. Darcy's offer of marriage. But then she relents after visiting his fabulous estate.
How long have you loved him?
Well, it's been coming on so gradually, I hardly know. But I believe I must date it from my first seeing his beautiful grounds at Pemberley.
All the male suitors in Pride and Prejudice come with a price tag attached. Mr. Darcy commands £10,000 a year, Mr. Bingley £5,000, with the villain Mr. Wickham getting his just desserts only £100 a year. Mary Guyatt, manager of the Jane Austen House Museum in Chawton, Hampshire, concedes that money is Austen's dominant theme.
Social status and income, you know, appears in all the novels.
It all sounds a bit mercenary now.
Well, of course, Jane was making a comment on the fact that women relied upon making a good marriage for their economic security.
Jane herself accepted an offer of marriage and of economic security from a wealthy neighbour, Harris Bigwither. But on reflection, she backed out, deciding not to become Mrs. Bigwither after all. Professor Sutherland.
It's an extremely brave decision, because if she'd married this man, she would have had a nice house, a nice estate. But immediately, having refused that marriage, she then begins writing in earnest and sends off her first novel to a publisher. So I think she does see that as a moment when she's, as it were, made her choice, and her choice is to try to make money from her novels.
She didn't really succeed in that aim. She made in total no more than $25,000 in today's money. But she did write her way into the hearts, and now that her image will appear on the new banknote, into the wallets of millions. Stephen Beard, DW, Winchester.
Drop us a line if you have any comments or queries about the programme. Our email address is europe@dw.com. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. In the next half hour, a special report on the marching season in Northern Ireland. Is the mafia behind bushfires devastating parts of southern Italy? And why less is more when it comes to taking the plunge here in Germany? This week, a ceremony in front of Hungary's neo-Gothic parliament in Budapest marked the arrival of the first Israeli prime minister to visit the country since the collapse of communism in 1989. Hungary's prime minister, Viktor Orban, stood alongside Benjamin Netanyahu as he said that his country's collaboration with Nazi Germany during World War II was a mistake and a sin, as it failed to protect its Jewish community. Our correspondent Stefan Bors followed the visit and explained to me why the issue of anti-Semitism was so important.
The Hungarian government had launched a campaign against George Soros, the Hungarian-American billionaire, basically because they opposed the philanthropist's support for migration and refugees. But that campaign was very much criticized by Jewish organizations for its perceived anti-Semitic overtones. The government of Prime Minister Viktor Orban denies that. And the populist Orban said he had told Netanyahu that he was aware of Hungary's painful history, which of course also included its cooperation with Nazi Germany during World War II. Some 600,000 Hungarian Jews were killed in the Holocaust.
Minden magyar kormánynak az a kötelessége, hogy minden állampolgárát.
Orban notes that every Hungarian government has the duty to protect all of its citizens, regardless of their heritage. He explains that at an earlier time, the government of Hungary made a mistake, moreover committed a sin, when it did not protect its citizens of Jewish heritage. The Hungarian leader also says that during World War II, Hungary did not comply with this moral and political requirement, and he adds that this is a sin because at the time we decided that instead of protecting the Jewish community, we choose collaboration with the Nazis.
Several Jewish groups, however, have expressed concern about the Hungarian government's anti-migration campaign and its perceived flirting with the far right ahead of upcoming elections next year. Now, did Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu address those concerns?
Yes, and I think it was interesting that Netanyahu said he thought about Hungary first concerning the birth of modern Zionism. He spoke about Theodor Herzl, who he called Israel's modern Moses, who was born in Budapest in 1860. He also made clear that he believes that Orban is distancing himself from anti-Semitism.
Well, Netanyahu and Orban also met the leaders of Poland, the Czech Republic and Slovakia, which are Hungary's partners in the so-called Visegrad Group. Why was that meeting so important?
Well, Prime Minister Netanyahu seeks support for Israel's opposition towards the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement within the European Union, protesting Israel's policies towards Palestinians. The Visegrad Group and Israel agreed to set up a working group to fight Islamic terrorism in the world, but he also wants them to recognize an undivided Jerusalem as Israel's capital. In fact, he was caught by a live microphone railing against what he called the European Union's crazy insistence on resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a precondition for closer ties with the 28-state bloc. Now, I think for the Visegrad group, this meeting was also very crucial, as it, of course, raises its stature, and especially for Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who has been isolated within the EU because of his perceived autocratic style, and now he can show that he not only meets leaders of Russia and Kazakhstan, but also an important leader such as Benjamin Netanyahu.
And that was our Hungary correspondent, Stefan Bors. Fires have been ravaging large parts of southern Italy over the past week. The authorities say there's been a record spike in wildfire incidents. One place has attracted particular attention, Mount Vesuvius, outside Naples. Officials there say the fires appear to have been caused by arson. And some are pointing their fingers at the local mafia. Irena Caselli reports.
We're driving up the slopes of Mount Vesuvius. Around us, there are vineyards and fruit trees. This is volcanic land, and it is very fertile. There are also some buildings which were built illegally around 50 years ago. And just a kilometer ahead of us, uphill, lies an extension of Mediterranean scrub. And that is what the fire is burning now. This airplane has just dropped some water on one of the fires, and it's circling over the area. This is already the third time to drop off water and to try and extinguish these fires, which have been burning this part of the wood for about a week. San Giuseppe Vesuviano is one of the towns up on the hills of Mount Vesuvius, on the other side of the volcano in relation to world-famous Pompeii. Vincenzo Catapano is the town's mayor. He has been watching on helplessly as the fires raged on in the bush hundreds of meters away from the last buildings in his town.
This small piece of paradise is burning down. It makes you feel like crying when you watch what represents our world going up in flames. We're asking for help. We have asked for help. We've asked for more ground patrols to put out the fires once and for all, as well as more help using airplanes.
Authorities have found it difficult to put out the fires because the ignition points were spread across a large territory. This year's lack of rainfall and strong winds contributed to the fires spreading more rapidly. Images of this world-famous volcano covered up in smoke resembled those of the famous eruption in 79 AD and worried the population. At this march in Naples, one of the banners reads, "Our land is burning." Common citizens and activists are here to get answers from the authorities. They are demanding an inquiry to find those responsible for what they call an avoidable tragedy. Agostino Casillo is the president of the Vesuvius National Park. He says preventing these fires would have been difficult.
There's no doubt that we're looking at a criminal act. This was surely a case of arson. The fire started off in different areas of the park, very far away from each other. This was done on purpose to make the firefighting operations difficult. It could have been avoided if these criminals had been arrested before they acted. This is why we need to give an exemplary punishment to these criminals.
But who would want to set fires to a protected area? This is an area that attracts tourists from all over the world who flock to the excavations at Pompeii and Herculaneum. But plenty of people are against rules imposed by the national park. One of them is Vincenzo Cozzolino. His family owns Green Hill, a lush restaurant in San Giuseppe Vesuviano. The restaurant was built during the area's construction boom 50 years ago, and it sits in the national park.
We have this park, but how do we access it? We need to create new trails just to get into it. The area has to be cleared. We can't cut down the trees. We have to buy our wood elsewhere. We can't even pick up the wood that lies on the ground. In order to do anything, we have to get rid of this park. It has no use.
The clapping that follows Mr. Cozzolino's statement shows that he's not alone in disliking the park's authorities. But of course, he's not in favor of setting the mountain on fire. His view, however, shows how difficult an issue this is. The park represents a green safe haven in a heavily urbanized area, where the Camorra, the local mafia, have carried out illegal activities for years. For example, there are dozens of illegal buildings way up on the mountain that would be at risk if Mount Vesuvius, which is still an active volcano, were to erupt. But over the past few years, the Vesuvius National Park has been clamping down on these illegal developments. Michele Bonomo is the regional president for the environmental NGO Legambiente. He says that the local mafia is unhappy with the meddling of the authorities.
Noi crediamo che sia soprattutto un attacco alla legalità.
The Vesuvius National Park is a sort of bastion of biodiversity, but it's also a bastion of legality vis-à-vis criminal organizations that are used to controlling this area. And any action that tries to get back control of this area threatens their supremacy. So these fires were one of their responses, one of their strategies to reassert their control.
As soon as the fires are put out, the authorities will be able to assess just how big the damage is. Meanwhile, prosecutors have opened an investigation. Their hope is to be able to shed more light on this case and to be able to avoid such tragedies in the future. Irene Caselli, DW, Mount Vesuvius.
Nearly 20 years on from the end of the conflict in Northern Ireland, Protestant and Catholic communities are still largely divided, particularly in working-class areas. Tensions can flare easily, especially around July the 12th, when Protestant communities celebrate the victory of the Protestant king, William of Orange, over the Catholic king, James II, in 1690. The Orange Order, a Protestant fraternity, marches through the streets of the capital, Belfast, and other towns with flute bands, sometimes through Catholic areas. Protestants say it's their culture, but Catholics argue that some of their behaviour is provocative. Our reporter Louise Osborne visited Belfast to find out why the parades still happen and why they're so contentious.
The high shrill tones of a dozen flutes clash as the players tune up their instruments. Music sheets balance on stands in front of the musicians as they scrape back their chairs and take a seat at the front of the dark room. The walls are decorated with Union Jack flags and red, white and blue bunting hangs from the ceiling. These are not what you might think of as typical flute players. Dressed in jeans and football jerseys, tattoos peeking out from under their short sleeves, middle-aged men press their weathered fingers to the instrument holes. Others standing behind the flute players beat rhythmically on drums hanging from their necks. Are the Shankill Road Defenders, a military-style flute and drum band based in Belfast's notorious loyalist stronghold, Shankill Road. Today is their last practice before they march with hundreds of other loyalist bands in the Orange Order parades. They take place every year in Northern Ireland on July 12th to commemorate the victory of Protestant King William of Orange over Catholic King James II in 1690.
It's just tradition, you know, and the way I could compare it would be like a royal family, the way the royal family continues their traditions. Even with the Roman Catholic Church, you know, the Pope has his address on Easter Monday or Easter Sunday. It's just tradition, and it's something that we have.
Sam Bailey began playing with the Defenders when he was 17 years old, at the height of the conflict in Northern Ireland. It pitted loyalists, mostly Protestants dedicated to Northern Ireland remaining part of the United Kingdom, against mostly Catholic nationalists, who wanted to see the country united with the Republic of Ireland. Terrorist paramilitary groups like the pro-nationalist Irish Republican Army, better known as the IRA, and the Loyalist Ulster Defence Association, or the UDA, waged a guerrilla war known as the Troubles from the late 1960s until a peace agreement was signed between the main parties in 1998. During the Troubles, Loyalist bands like the Shankill Road Defenders helped keep boys off the streets, says Sam.
He had the ban, and that sort of kept us indoors. them used to practice twice a week sometimes, you know, and same when they were riding out in the streets, you know, it was just to fall back on, you know.
But that's not how everyone sees it. Some flute bands have been linked with loyalist paramilitary organisations and are also viewed negatively because of their sectarian music and behaviour during the parades, says Dominic Bryan, a reader in social anthropology at Queen's University Belfast.
It's hyped up because when they go through nationalist areas, there's often people protesting. There's people shouting at them. So you create this environment. That said, I watched them take paramilitary flags through. They've taken banners through of paramilitary people in loyalist paramilitaries.
60 years on from their inception, the Shankill Road Defenders have been trying to work with different communities. They're involved with an integration project called Beyond Skin, and one of their projects, Music Unite, aims to bring together different cultures. They are trying to break away from the negative view of loyalist flute bands held by nationalist communities, among others. Dominic says that the Irish Nationalist Party in Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin, have been responsible for some of the negative hype around the flute bands, but that they are in no way completely responsible.
If you think it's just Sinn Féin, then you're not understanding Irish nationalism. You're not understanding the experience of nationalists and Catholics in Belfast and other places who do get to experience loyalism in a very real and very threatening way. You know, it's not Sinn Féin that put the Irish tricolours on top of a bonfire on the 11th night and burn them. You know, it's loyalists that do that. So it's very difficult to say that nationalists don't have any reason to have any fears if you watch about that behaviour.
And there's a pig with a flag on. And a bonfire.
In a small wasteland, surrounded by bushes and trees and a housing estate, a group of boys and girls scramble up a huge tower of wooden pallets, topped off with tyres. They proudly place three green, white and orange flags on top of the structure. At midnight, young men pour petrol on the pyre and set it alight. The tricolour flag of the Republic of Ireland burns as members of the community watch, chat and dance with drinks in hand. The kids, draped in Union Jack flags and wearing red, white and blue face paint, run around excitedly. Protestant communities across Northern Ireland light bonfires on the evening of the 11th of July to commemorate the arrival of King William in Ireland. On bonfires in other areas, effigies of the Pope and other Catholic and nationalist symbols burn alongside the flag. Not everyone on this estate agrees with the practice.
It's what the men do, you know. Unfortunately, that's out of our control. We just fundraise and that's it, you know. That's not nothing to do with me, or I can't control that. Certainly wouldn't listen to me if I said I'd rather you didn't do that, you know. But it's just it, you know.
Kellyanne McCubry is 35 and has three small children. She grew up in the small, mainly Protestant housing estate in impoverished, working-class North Belfast. Kellyanne has been fundraising for the party throughout the year. Sitting in the small community centre, surrounded by Union Jack bunting, she chats to the pensioners who have come over for a drink and a sandwich as music blares outside. It's a fun day out for the community, she explains.
Normally, the 11th day, we would hire bouncy castles and have barbecues and face painting for the kids. And kids basically just run ragged and enjoy themselves. Then, end of the night, we would have some music and we would light the kids' bonfire at 8 o'clock. And then at 12 o'clock, the big bonfire gets lit and everybody else will come out then for it. It's my culture, you know. I'm not, I don't have any kind of hatred for Catholics, or it's not about that, you know. It's about the culture that I've grew up in, and I don't hate anybody because they're Catholic. I'm just celebrating my culture, you know, and that's it.
Still, Catholic and nationalist communities stay away from the bonfires and the parades the next day. Many leave Northern Ireland for the Republic during the July 12th celebrations. They feel intimidated and unwelcome in Belfast and elsewhere. Some feel written out of the country entirely, says 86-year-old Malachy Scott, who lives in a predominantly Catholic nationalist area in North Belfast, as he watches the bands march past.
We don't see the tricolour about. We're Irish people and are not part of our own country. They think we didn't exist. Just seems to be, the attitude seems to be, oh, Northern Ireland's part of Britain, part of the UK. End off. What's our problem? You know, that sort of thing. And it can be very frustrating.
Families with children wrapped in Union Jack flags line Donegal Place, one of Belfast's main shopping streets. They cheer and smile as men dressed in military uniforms march along the road, the sound of flutes and drums filling the air. Barely half a mile away, the flute tunes can just about be heard on the wind. A father rushes his three children beyond the walls of the Carrick estate onto the main road. Not far into the mainly Catholic estate, a man wearing shorts and a T-shirt in the warm sun waters his plants.
Up until 3 years ago, it was pandemonium around here.
Frank Dempsey has lived in this area for more than four decades. Parade season here was often marked with protests by nationalists who opposed the marches, particularly those passing through Catholic-majority areas like this one. It often led to violence and riots. But Frank says things have changed, here at least.
People of this area just had a request to be a bit of respect. They wanted no music from a certain stretch of the road, short stretch, and no supporters. And for the past 3 years it's been like that. And this area has changed dramatically since it. It's quietened down, you've walked about the area, there's nobody standing out there protesting. The bands are going by, just no music, no supporters. So it's happy times here.
Still, it's a fragile understanding. Unionists insist marching is an important part of their culture. Over the years, they've been prevented from marching along traditional but contentious routes that border nationalist parts of the city, or even go right through them.
They've got their own culture. They're entitled to celebrate their own culture. But what they're not entitled to, they're not entitled to ram it down our throats. They're not entitled to compass their ears and intimidate our people. They're not entitled to go by our churches and sing and dance outside the churches. And they're certainly not entitled to think that we're second-class citizens. It has to be a shared city. It has to be a shared future. And it's about time we start to realise this isn't 1690. It's long gone out there.
Divisions clearly still remain between the two communities. But there are those hoping the resentment won't go on with their children. People on both sides are working to bring the kids and the communities together, says Kellyanne McCubry.
The kids are always encouraged to do cross-community, you know, and the kids will go away on weekends with Sky Camp with the other communities, and it always works well. The kids really enjoy it, you know, and they do make friends out of it. So, you know, it's good to do that, and it's always encouraged.
This year was one of the most peaceful on record between the two communities. But as long as tensions continue to simmer below the surface, the fear of violence lingers on.
Louise Osborne with that report, which was also compiled by Jennifer Collins. I'm Helen Seney in Bonn, and you're listening to Inside Europe. It's been a pretty warm summer so far here in Germany, so it's lucky that the country is home to 12,000 natural lakes, because that's where everyone wants to be at the moment, and in various stages of undress, as we hear from Tamsin Walker in this postcard from Berlin.
That is the familiar sound of summer in and around Berlin. The crush and throng of tiny trains packed with
prams, beach paraphernalia and bikes, all being shunted, like their owners, beyond the city limits into the great watery beyond of Brandenburg, the lake-rich state that encircles the German capital. It has a magnetic effect on Berliners during the warmer months, pulling them out of their homes and onto its numerous sandy shores and boggy banks. And it's much the same story up and down the country.
I think most Germans like to be at the waterfront, to have this beautiful view. As soon as it is warm enough, people go to some kind of water and try to swim.
Hartmut Rein, an expert in sustainable tourism, says the lake swimming trend that's now very much a part of the fabric of this society took off around the turn of the last century, when trains made it possible for people who didn't live close to the water to explore the pitted landscape around them. And something else lake-related was also starting to take off around the same time. Or, to be more exact, was being taken off. Though my own virgin visit to a German lake now lies deep in the past, the experience itself lives on in the depths of my mind, and the glorious technicolour of the experience hasn't faded over time. It was my first ever encounter with FKK, an abbreviation for the Freikörperkultur, or free body culture, that sees scores of people strip off to salute the sun in the buff. Gawping from behind my sunglasses and feeling very overdressed in my bikini, I remember being forced to acknowledge what a sheltered life I'd led. Turns out I was about a century behind the curve.
It came up in the turn of the century, 1900, because it was a kind of liberalization, to be outside, to be close to nature, to be in the sun, to be part of the nature, to be against the conventions, traditional in this time. It was a Prussian time. It was when we had Kaiser Wilhelm. So it was a really conservative, and it was the opposite.
During those early years, the movement attracted both followers and attention. And though it suffered setbacks under Hitler, who disbanded FKK groups or had them forcibly integrated into Nazi organisations, it continued to capture the imagination of Germans eager to show the human body is nothing to be ashamed of. Driven by that determination, public nudity experienced another awakening in the post-war Germany of two halves. Most notably in the East, where by the mid-1950s, it had become state-sanctioned. 2 decades later, it was entirely mainstream, embraced with a passion that for many has endured. A lot of larger lakes in the former eastern states still have a designated FKK or nudity zone. But even at smaller ones, it's perfectly common to see people sunbathing, boating, or splashing about in the water with nothing on. And having shed my Victorian disbelief of old, I've even been known to join them. Yes, I'm quite happy to throw my clothes to the wind to convene with nature in my most natural of states. Because there is something truly liberating about sitting in the nuddy on the banks of a lake, knowing that nobody will bat an eyelid. Except, perhaps, the British newcomers hiding behind their sunglasses.
Tamsin Walker shedding her inhibitions there in the lakes around Berlin. That's all we've time for, but we'll be back at the same time next week. I'm Helen Sini, and on behalf of sound engineer Jürgen Kuhn, thanks for tuning in. Inside Europe comes to you from Deutsche Welle in Bonn.